what to do, yeah. Okay, a very warm welcome to Dave Taylor. And Dave, that is fabulous. And obviously, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Vince. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, hang on. So what number are you on there? You've number five. Sorry about that. Okay, number five, Mike. Now on, Dave, we should be able to say properly a welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Vince. Nice to be here.
Well, it's fabulous. Listening to that and thinking immediately of people I like, playing, that is just up there with the best. It's fantastic. Now, whereabouts do you produce that sort of music? Is it in your own studios? Or is it?
Well, nowadays, yes, it is. Although now I'm living in Spain, of course, my studio is in England. But a lot of the later, sort of for the past 10 years, I've recorded at home. That particular track was recorded in Helsinki in 1978.
And, I think I said to you before we started chatting today that, I always liked Jules Holland. I like his music. I like it when he plays with other people. The enthusiasm is there. The movement is there. But, I mean, that's every bit as lively, every bit as strong. You've obviously been playing your piano for a long time.
Yeah, I've been playing it, sort of all my life, at least 40 years. So, it's the sort of music I like.
And how did you get into it? What prompted your enthusiasm and like for it?
I don't know, really. I've always liked boogie-woogie, and when I was sort of, I don't know, 5, 6, I used to tinkle around on the piano and try to play boogie-woogie like Fats Waller and people like that. And eventually my mum sent me for piano lessons, and I ended up taking a degree in classical music. Mm. And but I wasn't, if you like, that interested in the other side of the classical music. It was a bit boring, so I wanted to put what I'd learnt to good use, as it were, and went down the rock and roll path.
Now, we're going to look at some other aspects of your music a little later on, but I want to go to the likes of the 1960s, because those were the days when, if you were playing boogie-woogie piano, you must have had some experience with bands and groups.
Well, in the, say, 1960s, I wasn't doing much, because obviously I was only sort of 12 years old in the 60s. So I didn't really get playing properly until about 1972. That was when I first started playing in bands.
Okay, even at the tender age of 12, probably you were listening to people.
Oh, yeah, I was listening to a lot of people. Mm. Brian Paul, for example, and, of course, Bill Haley and Count Basie, a real mixture of people.
Mm. And where were you living then?
I was living in Nottingham.
Okay.
In England.
Yeah, and what about the scene in Nottingham, sort of? It would be just probably 70s then.
Yeah, it was obviously disco music and things like that was top of the pops, which I didn't like at the time. And so I started forming my own bands and playing in other bands. And 73, 74, the biggest show I did was in 72, funnily enough, at Wembley. I played with Little Richard and everybody there, but I was only 15
at the time. I'm going to ask Paul, who's in the back studio, to come through so he can... Paul's just arrived. I want to introduce him to you so that obviously he hears about your career and everything. Let me just also ask you about your work in the college, because whereabouts did you do your degree, for example?
It was in London, in the Royal Academy of Music in London.
And a lot of musical courses tended, certainly in the earlier days, to steer away from, shall we say, rock and roll and blues.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was very, very highbrow stuff, and I used to have a quiff in those days, and I used to turn up in my teddy boy suit, and they didn't like it one bit. You know, it was very, very highbrow stuff.
This is very interesting because, if people who are supposed to be teaching you about music can't spot that you might be a bit different, but you've obviously got a talent in a certain part of music, I find that rather strange and rather alarming, actually.
Well, when I was 13, a good example was when I was invited to play at this festival, and I was asked to play a kind of music, sort of classical, but in my own style. So I ended up doing a rock and roll version of Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, and they were disgusted with it, and I was expelled for that.
Let me welcome in Paul Melba, because obviously...
Hello, hi, Paul.
It's nice
how
for you to
both
meet you. I knew that you'd like to get together, and obviously, Paul, we're just... first of all, I'll get Paul to get his...
Right, hang on.
He's nearly there.
Hello, I'm with you.
Yeah, there, okay.
Hang on, I'll switch me Yes.
Okay.
My mic on?
Yep, you're on.
Not fully.
We're putting you up just a little bit. There we are. That's it.
That's as big.
We've got you.
Big as you get. I can just about hear you.
We're talking to Dave about his career and the fact Dave went to study music at university.
Yeah.
But the teachers didn't spot that, although it was not maybe the classical that he was good at, there was something there that they should have been saying, wow, this is somebody who's maybe got something a little different here. What can we maybe add into the mix of our courses?
Yeah, like an institute, I suppose. All things like that in acting as well. When you go to an acting school, they give you the stuff from the bottom up. They teach you how to walk and teach you really stage presence and stage importance, really. You upstage hand, downstage knee, all this business, which is really common sense because you've got a rake on the stage. But the same with the voice. If you're going to teach a voice, you teach it from the ground upwards and know how to use the voice properly. And in piano, they give you finger exercises and start from that. And if they find that they've got a talent for classical, then by all means, give them the classical. Because like in acting, if you can make sense of Shakespeare, for instance, you already are way ahead in the acting profession as well, because if you can make sense of that and act it.
I'll tell you what I find interesting, though. You see, that I can remember the first time I went to my college, and the first thing they do is they give you a book, which has been, a book list, which is regurgitated. It's all the stuff that everybody's been doing every year on the course.
Yeah.
And if I'd have been there later as a teacher, and somebody like Dave had come in, and Dave had been sort of playing something which was very exciting, very different, I think I'd be wanting to tap into it and say, where does it sit in with me courses?
Yeah, but I think in the 70s they didn't want to do that. It was,
oh, I'm sure they
it
didn't.
Was very, very different.
Yeah, I'm sure.
If you've got the potential to do something, I think, feed it in, feed that.
But the learning part was very good. I mean, obviously, it's stood me in good stead all these years, so it was very important that I did learn the correct way, as it were. Mm.
OK, well, let's go to 1975. Now, this is an advert that you replied to in the Melody Maker. So tell us about what was it that you were replying to and what happened?
Well, it was, I'd been playing in local bands in Nottingham, and it was a bit sort of boring and not really getting anywhere. So I decided to advertise in the Melody Maker, which was at the time one of the biggest music papers around.
Yeah.
And I got a reply from a London agent who booked me with a band to go to Denmark straight away. So, you know, the following day I passed the audition, which, strangely enough, that was funny in itself, because when I got there, they were actually auditioning sax players. So when I turned up, they said to me, right, where's your sax? I said, I haven't got one. He said, well, you can borrow this one. I said, well, it's no good, I can't play the sax. He said, well, what are you doing here then? And I said, I've come for an audition on the piano. He said, no, we don't need a piano player. Anyway, after auditioning all these sax players, they said, well, let's give him a go, as it were. And out of all the sax players, they chose me on piano. So it was quite a strange thing. And the next day, we was in Copenhagen.
Well done.
And then you also had an experience with Chuck Berry that looks interesting. Tell us about that.
It was not interesting at the time, but it's created a few laughs since. I mean, obviously, he was not exactly one of my heroes, but obviously one of the greats of rock and roll. So, you've got to appreciate the guy. He's been around forever. And I was booked to play with him and my band in 1976, I think it was, on the Isle of Man, the TT races. We did our show, which was, great and everything. We enjoyed it. And then the big man came on, and he wouldn't tune up to the piano, which most guitarists would do. He refused to tune to the piano, and he said that I've got to tune to him. Well, of course, this was a Steinway Grand that had been, professionally tuned anyway. And he was snarling at me all the way through the show and saying, the piano player's playing out of tune. And eventually, I mean, I was only 18 years old, and I just got up in the middle of the set and I put two fingers up at Chuck Berry and I walked off.
Well done.
And I didn't get paid either.
Well, sadly, that's the price you pay. Standing up for yourself.
He's the old man of rock and roll, but as you say, the older you get, sometimes the sense goes out, doesn't it? Yes. A piano is like the centre of the orchestra, really, isn't it?
I've known a lot of musicians who have also played with him, and they've all agreed that he's actually a very, very difficult person to work with. He's not one of the nice people.
Mm. He's the diva of...
But there you go.
Yeah. It takes all sorts. I'm looking at the fact that you've met up with Screaming Lord Sutch. Now, he was a showman.
Absolutely.
No matter what anybody says about Screaming Lord Sutch, he was a showman. He had some fantastically off-the-wall ideas.
Yeah.
And I think he, in many ways, the fact that he actually did what he did livened up the political debate,
well,
didn't it?
Yeah.
And he's described, or he had at the time, described you by saying, I've worked with some of the best in the business, and then he reckoned that you were one of the greatest. So what was that accolade like for you?
Well, it was very good, because he's worked with a lot of Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton and all them sort of people, and he said that, you know, he put me on the same sort of pedestal as them, which I thought was great coming from him.
Well, fabulous.
Then let's go to 1977, and this was leading towards connections with Radio 1. Tell us about those days.
Yeah, there was a big march in London, I remember, to get rock and roll on the radio, because there wasn't much of it in those days. And we got about, I don't know, 50,000 people together and played on the back of a lorry and ended up with a big concert at Pickett's Lock. And eventually, because of that, we got on the radio with a guy called Dave Price and Stuart Coleman, who later went on to produce with Shaking Stevens. Mm. And they had a rock and roll show on Radio 1 every week for many, many years.
Yeah. Now, off we go next to Finland. A very, very interesting story, this, as we look at a 20-year-old Dave. You got an invitation to go back to Scandinavia. Why had you been to Scandinavia in the first place?
Well, we went there in 76 with this band that I joined, that I went to Denmark with. And they wanted to change their name and call themselves Matchbox, which they did, and they became obviously very famous and had many hits. But I wanted to, you know, branch off and do my own things. So whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not sad that I did it. I left that band. I left all them hits, unfortunately, but there you go. And I formed my own band, went back to Helsinki. And I ended up living there for 5 years.
And, of course, there's a guy I'm looking at. His name, Mikko, is it? What were the guys that sort of motivated you in Finland, and what did you do?
Well, in Finland, I got a band together and we started playing around up and down the country. And then I got introduced to some fantastic session players, you know, some of the best in the world even. And we got together and formed a 10-piece band and did 10-piece rock and roll, which was unheard of in Finland in those days.
Mm. Now, the thing that I think Paul might really relate to this probably more so than me, there's these acrobatics that you do. Now,
yeah.
I mean, seriously, Paul, you've never seen anything. You've got to go to, is it YouTube that the big one is on?
Yeah, there's one on there, on YouTube. Yeah.
If you go into YouTube on the computers and just put in Rockin' Dave Taylor, what actually comes up, Dave, because Dave sent me this, this is how we first sort of got to know each other, and I went to this YouTube piece of video, and there's Dave, certainly many thousands of people at a concert, and the next thing, he's up on the stanchion, the things that swing right out across the crowd.
It was the lighting rig, actually.
Oh, it was the lighting rig?
Yeah.
Okay, and he's only hanging upside down from the lighting rig. Was it Great Balls of Fire or something like that you were doing?
No, it was a song called Dim Light Boogie, which I'd written for the show.
Well, tell us, I mean, where did you start getting the urge to climb up the lighting rigs?
I've still been known to do it, but it depends on the audience. You know, if you get a buzz from the audience, that's all you need, and you can spring off from there, as it were. I don't like to just sit down and play the piano, because I think it's boring, and, you know, I like to jump about, and, you know, in fact, I did a radio interview in Hong Kong, and because he'd seen my show, he actually, in the radio, like we are now, he brought a piano in and said, can you play it with your feet? So I ended up playing live on the radio with my feet. And I thought, well, this is crazy, because nobody can see this. It was bizarre, but there you go, that was Hong Kong.
Yeah, and of course Archie Andrews made a career, didn't he? So,
yes, very much. But I think that's it relates to, you know, doing your act. When you've been doing it for many, many years, your act, you go on every night thinking, oh, it's the same routine again, or you'll swap it and put it round and sort of refresh the act and put those nerves and the adrenaline back in the act. And I've been, as you know, 52 years as a pro now, 56 when I turn pro, and there isn't anything I haven't done in the game, but I still find with all of those things, they get boring. No matter what importance in the Royal Command performance, I remember halfway through going, oh, Christ, I'm doing that again. I'm doing this same routine, and I wanted desperately to change it. And like Dave just said, to do anything different, to change it, is fabulous.
Yeah, it is.
You're
right.
You're injecting a new personality into the act. It's you.
And it's better if it's spontaneous as well.
It is, and it looks good.
I mean, like the shows that I've been doing, I've done a few shows in Spain just for fun almost, but... it's good because I ended up playing with a glass or a bottle or anything. And one day I decided, somebody made a joke and said, I bet you can't play with a chair. So I started playing a piano with a chair and playing a solo with a chair. Well, and then on the following gig, all the people turned up and said, give him a chair, give him a chair. And so they handed me this chair and I just said, oh, thanks so much, and I put it down and sat on it. You know,
tell us about that big gig you did up in Barcelona.
Yeah, that was, I think it was 87, it was a festival that was organised by my good friend Carlos Segarra that we were just talking about from the Spanish band Los Rebeldes. And, yeah, there was 300,000 people there, and I went on stage at midnight. Unfortunately, there was another guy, Wilson Pickett, was booked on it. And for some strange reason, they had my name at the top of the bill and his name below it, and he didn't like that. I didn't care, because it don't make any difference to me. Obviously, he's a... quite a superstar, so I didn't care. But he refused to play unless they changed the posters. And of course, they'd printed up like a million of these posters. And they said, no, we can't do that. So he went home. So, I ended up doing a show on my own. But it was good fun.
And how many reckon was that the... Was that back
there? Was 300,000 people in the audience. It was something to see, because I was... When I walked out on stage... I could see this mass of, people. And right as far as I could see, then they had the mixing desks and video screens so that the people behind there could see. So it was
fabulous.
Quite something.
I'm going to play one of your tracks here, and we're going to continue this onto the Costa Blanca side, the other side of the news, but I want to make sure we do play something that maybe you can have a listen to. Boogie Woogie Country Girl interests me, because I do like country music, and Boogie Woogie, you can get it in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, rock and roll, the way I think about rock and roll is there are many aspects to rock and roll. I like country rock and roll, western swing, especially western swing, boogie woogie, which comes from 1920s, 1930s, big band jazz. So if you mix it all together, then that's hopefully what I've done.
to say, Dave, there's all sorts of influences in there. I mean, that's what intrigues me about this music that you play. I mean, there's a bit of virtually 6 or 7 different types of music there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And when you're composing things like this, do you feel... Do you feel the different sort of?
Yeah,
influences?
I do, because obviously I write a song, and I start off with a basic idea, which is usually just sort of boogie woogie, which is where I begin from, and then because I've got all these different influences that I like, I just let them flow in.
Mm. And I'm looking at what happened in 1985. Now this is to do with the Far East. Can you tell us how that developed and where did it go?
Well, yeah, I just I got booked to play in Hong Kong, and it was just a 6-month tour, which was great fun. I walked down there with people that Paul would know, like Jasper Carrot. And,
oh, yeah, yeah.
you know, it was great fun to play with these sort of guys, and I ended up staying there for 2 years. I lived there pretty much. And I was playing, you know, a lot of clubs there. And Hong Kong was a fantastic place.
It is a lovely, great place.
And obviously from there I went on to the Philippines. And then from there I went to Macau. And then from there I went to Japan. I just like playing in different countries, you know. I've played in a lot of countries. I enjoy it.
So I suppose really if you think about it, you probably had a compromise between making charts in the UK or developing things around the world, which you seem to have done very well.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of my sort of compatriots, if you like, they prefer to stay at home, they get married, they've got kids, and they're doing, you know, like a regular residency in one club or other or show in London or whatever. And I've always thought, well, no, I'd rather be off playing somewhere, you know, just, you know, it's just nice to get out of the country and move around.
Okay, now let's go to the Cannes Film Festival now. This was...
Big orchestral sounds, and I certainly love, you know, I love choirs from it. I love brass bands. I love brass bands. I think they're fabulous. And jazz, of course. And I won't swallow all of jazz, but quite a lot of jazz I like. And country and western, I like bluegrass.
But I always like to try and fathom out what it is that motivates people, because when all's said and done... You've both come from a very, very different time. You both come from maybe different angles, but there's always something that we can all communicate with the musical thing.
Yeah, you like it. I mean, you like country and western. You because he seems to come through an awful lot with you. And Dave, well, listen to Dave. He's had a background of classical music. He was trained, as I was. I was trained classical singing wise, and he's been trained classical piano wise. So there's a little crossover there, you know. And I think it's good grounding for it. You know, you can go anywhere. You can go anywhere. But I made the mistake of saying once to a guy who was a jazz man, and I said, well, you know, we have to go to the classicals, really. He said, no, no, he said, jazz phrases are found in classical music. You have jazz phrases in classical music.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, so jazz came first. So, you know, you go back to the drum when it started and then a penny whistle or whatever, and that was all down to rhythm, wasn't it? It was rhythm that started.
And, of course,
all.
A lot of it's also to do with who you meet in this, because, for example, you know, I would have always... I could play a little bit of piano, but more keyboard, but I wish that... Had I met somebody at the right time, I actually paid for a few lessons. I forget how old I would be, but this guy came to the house, and I must have spent, I think, 6 weeks knocking up Tristesse, you know, which is a very morbid play. You know, how would that inspire me? You know, by all means, when you become more accomplished, perhaps, you know, then you explore different moods. But I wanted something that... I told him I like boogie-woogie stuff. But because it probably didn't do boogie woogie, he never taught me it, you know. And I would have loved to be able to do that, you know. I mean, there are numbers of songs, boogie woogie songs, that I think are really, really good.
Yeah,
I mean, like
yeah.
All types of music, there's always stuff in there that just pads it out. But
well, my mother was classical trained, but she played boogie woogie, and it was I loved to listen to it. It was, you know, you can't feel miserable when that's played. You know, it's like a banjo.
Yeah.
You know, a proper banjo. And I think Billy Connolly made that comment once. He said, "You can't really feel down when a banjo's playing. It just lifts you up, doesn't it?"
Dave started off. Was it 8 that you told me, Dave?
Well, I started about 5, learning classical.
Yeah, and then when was the age that you met somebody that could teach you to play boogie woogie?
Nobody taught me to play boogie woogie.
You just
I never found anybody. I changed teachers a few times, and I didn't get anywhere with that. So I decided to teach myself. By then, I'd obviously been learning classical for sort of 5-6 years. So it was sort of easy to self-teach.
Right, OK, well, that's interesting.
But Boogie Woogie especially, you've got to feel it. You know, it's, you can't learn it.
We had Jerry Lee Lewis's sister at the Benidorm Palace. I went to see her, Linda Gale Lewis. And she was, I thought she was brilliant, actually.
Yeah, I've done a lot of shows with her. She's good. A little bit different to what I do, but similar.
Okay, I'm going to try and get Don on the line again. And while we do that, let's go to something which is probably you doing something that everybody will know straight away.